Yermak.
Kozlowski was in some ways your opposite number before.
Yes, I suppose he could be said. Rather, he was a combination of me and Professor Webster. Kozlowski was the dominant element on the American side of the preparation of the Charter, undoubtedly, at Dumbarton Oaks, and also at San Francisco.
As we move towards Bretton Woods and Yalta with the UN...
Nothing to do with Bretton Woods.
Nothing to do with Bretton Woods.
No.
But someone in the Foreign Office must have.
Nigel Ronald.
I see.
He's alive, I think.
Well, that's a good name to note down. We shall note down.
I think he was pretty old. I think he's still alive. He must be in the 90s.
What about the idea of this UN army and enforcement measures? Did you ever believe that there was going to be a UN army with air forces,
no,
navies?
No, not
and
really. But we had to go along with the idea because it was part of the general conception that there should be. I never believed it was very likely to happen, certainly not after the outbreak of the Cold War.
No.
But in principle, we had to go along with it. The Military Staff Committee was, that was in the Charter, and in principle, it was the thing to do. But it wouldn't really have worked, I can't think.
Even by Bretton Woods, it says here, Roosevelt was growing nervous about providing soldiers to the UN without the constitutional steps.
I didn't know that.
But do you know to this day the Military Staff Committee holds a meeting each month?
Does it still?
I may be wrong, but it did a couple of years ago.
Oh, it did until very recent, I know. And, it's still ridiculous, yes.
They used to meet, a general, an admiral, and an Air Force commander from each of the five, and grunt at each other and exchange a courtesy and...
fix the date of the next meeting. Now, that's been going on since 1940, whatever it was.
But the idea that that each of the five powers would... hive off a little army for the UN, you never took seriously.
I didn't think it very likely, no. We had to go along with the formalities, yes. I never thought myself it was very likely it would happen, no.
Were you in on a proposal at one point that there should be a United Nations Air Force?
No, I thought that was nonsense. Go and bombard everybody, which is rebellious and so
yes,
on. It's absurd.
The last kind of war that the UN
should
get involved in. Now, turning a little to the work after the San Francisco conference, you were, I suppose, I mean, we think of you as a kind of pre-Secretary General of the United Nations.
I was the Provisional Secretary General, so described, I believe, yes.
And, chaps like Brian Urquhart waddled in and asked for work, and you put them...
Well, he was my first recruit, actually.
Do you know about the Mohicans? Do you know what they are?
No.
It's a club.
Indians?
No. Well, of course, the novel of whatnot. But there's a club at the UN of those who were on board UN Secretariat before the 15th of August 1946. And obviously this is a club with a dwindling future, and eventually there will be the last of the Mohicans. But Brian is the first of the Mohicans.
I should have thought so.
Yes.
The first one, in a sense, was David Owen.
Yes.
Whom I was in, but he was more or less engaged with. I didn't actually take him on, but it's agreed that he should be a sort of number two in command of the general operations.
You mention him in the book as he was, I think, Cripps's.
He was Cripps's private secretary.
And he was a charmer. We knew him well in the
UN.
Yes,
I knew him well.
And he was a great fun, a Yorkshireman.
But the first actual recruit was Brian Urquhart, actually. He was my private secretary.
Who came to you after being
yes.
Foy Browning's personal assistant or something.
Yes, yes.
And having various disagreeable adventures in the war.
Yes.
But Brian, of course, is, as you know, a stalwart and has run the peacekeeping side since Punch's death for all the SGs since.
I know.
And is, as...
I suppose he'll retire soon, will he?
Well, he's been talking about retiring for about 30 years, but I see
how
no
old is he, 65?
Something like that. Not even that, I think.
62?
Something, yeah. But marvellous. So he's not only a man with all of that knowledge and skill on that peacekeeping side, but he has a sense of honour and propriety about the secretariat.
Absolutely.
Which is invaluable.
Yes.
If people seem to have had their rights as members of the secretariat assailed, Brian is the effective defender of the right.
Yes.
All right. Now you put together I see your report to the first London Assembly, the report of the Preparatory Commission. I assume it was largely drafted by you or your office.
Yes,
and you say that you put together the staff of the various departments,
we got out the rules of procedure, that was even more important.
Which were revised afterwards by a committee headed by a nice Canadian.
But they remained essentially the same.
Yes. Mm. But
except for the Security Council, which never adopted its rules of procedure.
No. But it has a repertoire of practice.
We had provisional rules of procedure.
Yeah.
At the first meeting, of course, and it worked on this basis for a long time.
I'm interested in really the this is the nucleus of the Secretariat, and having been a member of the Secretariat for 35 years myself.
Oh, really?
I'm interested in the extent to which you were aware of which your behaviour was affected by. The League experience and
League of Nations.
Yes.
No, I don't think it was really.
It wasn't. You really thought you were sort of creating afresh.
Oh, I thought we were thinking as we were creating something rather new, a newer version of the League, like. But it wasn't very much influenced by my experience in the United Nations. I did go to the United Nations quite a certain amount.
Yes.
But no, I can't remember thinking that I was influenced by that very much. I just recruited the most people who seemed to be most desirable for the job. And of course, you had to take to a very large extent, you had to take the nominees of the various states. You couldn't help it.
But among the English recruits, apart from Brian and David Owen, I see names like Hugh Williams, who's in fact a New Zealander, your information staff, which is, of course, the one that interested me because I came to know them all quite soon afterwards. Duckworth Barker, of whom we've spoken, and other good people. And then many of the overseas ones became ASGs and directors and whatnot under the...
Yes, how did they do it? A man called Cohen, I think?
Ben, yes, from Chile. Marvellous. Look, I've got to do this. Excuse me. We were talking about the Secretariat. Secretariat is now grown into a force of many thousands. The influence of the original nucleus remained for a long time and eventually proved to be a cause of some irritation to the new incoming powers who found all the top jobs occupied by Yanks and Limeys and Frenchman and
I didn't know anything about this internal goings on now. Nothing whatever.
Well, but it's changing now because the first generation is well on its way out, and all sorts of new people are in. But you must, even though you were not at this stage on the scene, a year after you left New York, the floodgates opened and the membership.
Well, that's not just Secretariat, I mean, the membership...
Yes, but it is, in other words, each member came and laid a claim to some share of the staff.
Well, I always thought they opened they opened the gates too rapidly, myself. And I thought that increasing the membership so quickly and admitting almost anybody who applied was probably a mistake.
What would you have...
Well, I think that under the Charter, you're able to... become a member of the United Nations as a state if you are willing and able to accept the obligations of the Charter.
And it further requires that you have to be peace-loving, which is one of
those things. Well, peace-loving, whatever that means. Everybody says they're peace-loving. they had to be willing and able to accept the obligations, whereas some were willing. I don't think many were able. And I think if the great powers had been agreed, if the Americans, the Russians had been agreed on not to admit people unless they were obviously capable of fulfilling the obligations, it might have been a good an advantage.
Well,
but of course it was all destroyed by a great power rivalry, because you couldn't veto somebody, because they might go to the other side.
Exactly. Well, as you know, the place was kept locked up precisely because the Russians wanted so-and-so in, and we wanted so-and-so in, and the divided countries.
Yes.
but as far as Africa and Asia were concerned, when you say Nigeria, Ghana's independent. Obviously, Ghana gets in and is acclaimed. Nigeria, similarly, and Madagascar and whatever. But when it then comes to Rwanda and Burundi is separate.
It's absurd.
But do you see that it's very difficult to say yes to the one and no to the other? Because
it was difficult, but something should have been done, in my view. It's ludicrous to think that the Maldive Islands has the same vote as China, and to say the other words.
Yes, it is. Was this in the early days, did you ever think of weighted voting? I know that it came up in the sense that at one point the Russians demanded a vote for each of their republics. That was at Yalta, wasn't it?
Yes, well, before Yalta they'd start talking of that. But then the United States said they ought to have a vote for all their constituent states.
Right. It started, didn't it, because the Russians said, look at the British, they're getting a vote for New Zealand and a vote for Canada.
Yes.
And then the compromise provided for Belarusia and the Ukraine.
Well, that should never have been conceded, really, unless, of course, the Americans were going to get California and New York. But it shouldn't have been conceded, but Roosevelt was so keen on appeasing Stalin that he agreed.
Were you
it
aware?
It didn't make any difference. Really.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, the Maldives and China vote doesn't make all that amount of difference either, because the votes in the General Assembly are.
Well, it was always thought that the Assembly should not have any great power. That was, therefore.
I'm sorry, it should not have
any very great power.
Meaning influence and
General
strength.
Assembly
right.
should have less influence than the Security Council, clearly.
By great power, at first I thought you meant US strength. No, okay. Well, it doesn't today. It has.
Well, it has more than it used to have, I suppose.
I suppose so, but moral suasion is still the principal tool there.
Yes.
And there are some countries that are morally swayed and others not.
Yes, quite true.
Did you, as the drafts of the Charter emerged, as you worked on them, were you, now you see, claim all sorts of things with the virtues of hindsight. Did you foresee any of today's problems coming up? Did you say so at the time? Did you warn and thump?
If I did, it's on the record. I can't recollect it.
I see. Is there anything that
I'm
you...
I'm afraid I've forgotten a great deal of that.
Well, we do. I thought I could at least provoke you into talking about some of the personalities that you you worked with. Is there anyone with whom you remember a flaming row in the Foreign Office? I don't mean on an issue of petty whatever, but on some principle, some UN principle. Is there anyone who
is? I don't really think so.
Peaceable man, are you?
Well, we had discussions. I don't remember having a great row about anything. No, I don't honestly remember having a great row. I don't think I do. We had discussions and divisions of opinions quite often. What should the row have been about? I don't quite understand.
Well, it might have been really about, say, India.
No.
Role of India in the future UN?
Certainly not, no.
Not a divisive thing back at...
No, I didn't remember it, no.
Lots of laughs about Roosevelt pushing China as a big member.
Well, we thought it was probably a mistake at that time, but we thought he had to go along with it.
along with it because of his own domestic China lobby?
Yes,
because
of course, I saw that. The great thing was to get America in firmly,
yes,
and not let America go isolationist. That was,
and recalling
after
the
First World War, that was the idea.
Yes. Did you have any dealings with the American senators who were initially thought to have been the ones who would make trouble and eventually became the great enthusiasts, Vandenberg and...
Well, I saw Vandenberg, but he was at the conference of Paris, peace conference, after
yes,
the war.
Yes.
And I saw him to some extent, but Dumbarton Oaks, no, I only saw him once or twice then, I think. But I met him once or twice at the peace conference, and Connolly too.
Yeah.
But I didn't have any long conversations with him, no.
who were, chiefly the people you were... had long conversations with were your colleagues of the Foreign Office, weren't they, or did you?
I suppose so. Yes, I were having conversations with Przybylski at enormous length, and Jimmy Dunn, of course.
Yes. What about the French? The idea of rescuing France and restoring her to great power status. I mean, must have.
Well, you're always in favour of that.
Yes.
The Americans died. Roosevelt sort of fought against it for a long time.
Well, based on really his antipathy to de Gaulle, right?
Well, perhaps not partly, yes. But I think he was misguided.
Yes. He was also moved by people like Admiral Leahy and whatnot, who were...
Yes, he was, very much so.
Is there, as the tape rolls, I'm instantly going to ask for another session when you can fit it in, and I will have collected a group of further questions and
yes,
listened to this.
Yes, all right.
Is there any great burning thought that you've never had a chance to get off your chest? Is there any bit of satisfaction that you look back on the UN with, or any great
disappointment? No, I think that perhaps I had a contribution to make, but I was partly responsible for the course of the Yalta voting formula, which I imagine was responsible for getting the Russians into it at all. And that emerged on a discussion at the end of Dumbarton Oaks between myself and Cadogan.
Yes.
I can't remember who suggested it first, but anyhow, it emerged from his conversation that I was authorized to make what turned out to be the Yalta voting formula to Przybylski, who then thought it was quite a good idea and agreed to consider it. And then I had a word with Sobolev in London when I came back after I urged it on him. And he seemed very agreeable to it, and I think he got round Molotov. But in any case, Stalin, unexpectedly rather, agreed to it at the Yalta conference. So I suppose that I was at least partly responsible for that, in the sense that I was partly responsible for something which, without which, wouldn't have come to being at all.
The history of the UN. The Yalta voting formula, meaning the five, the unanimity of the five powers.
You know, it meant that on the enforcement
yes,
section,
seven,
any
yes,
permanent member would have a veto, but that it would not have a veto on the previous section, which dealt with
Pacific
settlement
of disputes. And that there would be no veto on anything procedural.
Well, that was doubtful.
It was settled finally in that way, wasn't it?
There was agreement at San Francisco that procedural matters should also come essentially under the veto, but of course I disregarded that when I got the Chinese to come to New York.
You mean it was still an open question in 1950?
Well, it was an open question. Perhaps some people would have said that I'd violated the unofficial agreement in San Francisco, which no doubt I did.
As I've understood it, perhaps wrongly, the question of whether something is procedural or substantive is itself a procedural question.
Well, there's a doubt about that. There was under the San Francisco agreement, some might maintain that whether it's procedural or not was subject to the veto.
Under the charter?
No, not under the charter.
But under the agreement...
There was said to have been agreement among the, for the great powers at San Francisco.
How do you... I mean, now the Security Council is an enlarged body, although the five remain the five. When you have such an agreement, the Yalta voting, we agree by the... Here's what we write and sign in the charter, and by the way, we also agree on the Yalta voting formula. Along comes...
Yalta voting formula was incorporated in the charter.
It was. It was made explicit there.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
Well, except on this, as you say, on this procedural versus substantive...
Well, that was slightly open to doubt.
Yeah, there was an argument for a long time over there.
Oh, yes. Well,
because there's always a thing about these informal agreements that how can they possibly bind someone who is not a member at the time but who comes along afterwards and reads the rules of procedure and feels that he might. Mm. Perhaps I've drilled at the rock face, if I may put it like that.
No, I
don't. You all right? You're not in pain?
Good question for me. I never have, no. But... I'm not good at recalling my thoughts because they are really mostly vanished. I have very little recollection.
I thought I could sort of chivy you and stimulate you and ask you rude questions and you would say, good God, no. And
no.
But you're not that kind of person.
I'm not that kind of person. I don't react very quickly. I'm awfully sorry, but I do my best. I'm not good at it. I'm not good at it. I'm not good at it.
Look, let me now negotiate with you for a another 45 minutes of your time.
Yes, hello.
And come back, and I will...
leave your stuff here, if you like.
Well, I better take it.
Gotcha.
I better take it. I'm going to... I'll switch off here now.
Really?